Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or just trying to make life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Today I talked to June Hoffland. You may know her as one of the councillors of Ward 3 in the city of Guelph. But Hoffland cut her political teeth on an issue that's made its way back into the news this past summer, development of the area commonly known as the Lafarge site. Hoffland was one of a handful of area residents that banded together in the mid-aughts to protect the character of the neighborhood while recognizing the need to develop this big open area in the middle of the city. The history of organizing to protect the Lafarge lands and where we go next is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Now, once upon a time, Silver Creek Parkway South was the outskirts of Guelph. The first Sleeman Brewery was on that land, and it was so far from the center of town that the Sleemans ran a streetcar line to and from the core to get workers to the brewery and back every day. Decades later, the Lafarge Company would make cement there, thus conferring on the land its new permanent name. But that operation came to an end in the 80s, and the land status as a brownfield and being zoned as industrial made it difficult to redevelop after that. As a result, nature reclaimed the property, and it was adapted by the surrounding community as a nature trail, a bike path, and just a general open space. It was halfway through the last decade that there started to be rumblings that the Lafarge site's status as a natural space would soon be coming to an end. Developers had an eye to turn the land into a big commercial development, home to any one of several big box anchors that would attract several smaller tributaries. Area residents who had gotten used to the peace and serenity of the Lafarge site as it was did not like the sound of a major draw like IKEA or Costco, for example, moving into their neighborhood, at least not without a fight. This is where a woman named June Hoffland came to local prominence. Before running for city council, Hoffland was part of the Howitt Park Neighborhood Residents Association, who worked with the city and the developer to come to a compromise about how best to develop the land and how the expectations of all parties for that land might be able to be reconciled. The case went all the way to the Ontario Municipal Board, and a deal was reached almost 5 years later. And then nothing happened. For the last few years, there's been no sign as to when or where or what, if anything, will be developed there, as development has seemed to come down to a matter of chicken or the egg in constructing an underpass to connect both halves of Silver Creek Parkway. We'll get there in a few minutes, as June Hoffland and I get in the Wayback Machine for a trip through the last decade or so of fits and starts, the hurry-ups and waits, as neighbors in the area of the Lafarge site have been preparing for and dreading the day that development was meant to begin on the land there. And even though it's now being shorn of all trees, there's still no idea of what will be built on the Lafarge lands and when. But like I said, we will get there shortly. So I caught up with June Hoffland earlier this month in studio to talk about it. So June Hoffland, thank you for joining me today.
You're welcome. Nice to be here.
We're going to get in the Wayback Machine and go way back to the mid-aughts. And I don't know if that's sort of where the debate of the development of the Lafarge site, what's called the Lafarge site, and maybe there's maybe a better name, but than associating it with the one company, because it's been so many things over the centuries. But you are the representative of the area. You're the Ward 3 councillor, but before that you were just a neighborhood resident. So when did you first start hearing about the development? First of all, what was your relationship to the Lafarge area? And when did you start hearing rumblings about development there?
So, yes, this does go way back. And I have lived in the area, Adam, for over 30 years, and I've been walking my dog there for probably 30 years, and not just one dog. I've walked four dogs there over the course of 30 years, and really intimate with the property because I walked there two or three times in a week. And the Lafarge property, now I think I better correct myself, we should be referring to it as the former Lafarge property.
Right.
Or as they like to call it, the Silver Creek Junction. Mm-hmm. So I walked the property and was, as I said, very intimate with the property. And one day I saw a sign go up on the property, and I was curious about the wording. It was a sign put up by the city around a zoning amendment and an official plan amendment.
It's one of these white signs you see around when there's going to be a statutory public meeting about a development or a rezoning.
That's right. It's one of those big white signs. And in fact, I think I pointed it out to you one day when we were on site. But I saw the sign, and I was curious because I knew that the land was a prime place for development, but I thought that it was industrial property, and that was the current zoning. When I lived there, it was a they were making concrete block there, and it was, yeah, that was back in the 80s, and they had cleaned up the site and shut down the plant. So I went home and I called the city to find out what this all meant, zoning amendments, official plan amendments. I had no idea because I had lots of experience as an activist in my community, but I didn't know a lot about what went on inside City Hall. So it was a big learning curve. And from there on, I decided that I needed to have to get together with some neighbors and talk about how the neighbors were feeling about what I had learned. And I had learned that there was an application coming forward for 450,000 square feet of development. And it's a 22-hectare
right.
piece of property, or I don't know what that equates to in acres, but maybe 50.
Mm-hmm.
And so for several weeks and several months, a group of us met in my living room. I served up butter tarts to get people to come. And we talked about not stopping the development per se, but getting together and deciding what we would like to see on the property and what would be compatible with our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding that none of us had any real experience with fighting City Hall. So, as I said, the learning curve was quite steep. So that was my introduction to the former Lafarge property, just from walking on the property, seeing the sign, and then getting my neighbors together to talk about how we were going to ensure that this development would work in our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. You can actually, I don't know if you can still can see them. I haven't been down there since they started cutting down trees, but there are places where you can still see the concrete blocks lined up. They've been graffito tagged since then, but you know you can still see that where the footprint of where that plant was. I want to get to the how the neighborhood association came together, but I wanted to add this first of all is that you talked about you realized it wasn't about stopping development. It was about creating a compatible development. And that's something I remember from interviewing members for an article I wrote for the Ontarian years and years ago, was that it was always a very pragmatic thing. It wasn't like a stop the Walmart kind of protest. It was, we know this is a big empty space in the middle of the city, sandwiched between a major highway and major arterial roads. But this is also about a neighborhood that's gotten used to having a certain area here, certain probably very quiet area if you backed out onto it. So it was about working with the developers instead of working against the developers.
Absolutely right from the start. That's what it was about. Having said that, there were many that wanted to do nothing. They just they were adamant that the property should just stay as the property was, listed as industrial, and wait for someone to come along and develop that into some industrial plant. Of course, we were shocked when we learned that it was 450,000 square feet of commercial, because we knew that our neighborhood could not accommodate that kind of commercial development with the traffic flow and existing roads. And we also knew that with Silver Creek not being a through street, that all the traffic was going to shortcut through the small streets and along Waterloo Avenue. So,
yeah,
it was never, getting back to your question, it was never, you know, we weren't ever really against, but we were never really for. We wanted to find a way, as I said, that the neighborhood could live with what was going to be developed on that property. Some more background on that is that, yes, the neighborhood did take ownership of that land because it sat there. We watched it reforest. It was a beautiful piece of property with all the trees, and there was lots of people that liked to dog walk there. There were nature trails. There were bike trails.
The creek?
There was a lot of us played in the creek. Our dogs swam in the creek. But also there was beautiful, I think they're called BMX bike trails, mm-hmm. made in the sand dunes, and kids were playing there every day. They built jumps and a pretty great place in the middle of the city. So, yeah, once we got over the fact that this was going to be developed, then we decided we need to take some positive steps and learn the language of City Hall, first of all, and learn how we could, as I said, move forward in a positive manner.
So how did this transform from being the butter tart meeting in your living room to becoming a formal group and, that becoming that advocacy, that formal advocacy structure that works, that manages to work with City Hall on its own ground?
Well, as I said, we sat in my living room probably weekly for several months, maybe even into 2 years. And during those meetings, we educated each other on the processes at City Hall. We talked about what we wanted to see there. We had visioning sessions. We met with City Hall, and City Hall was very open and helped us along the way. They gave us an audience, and at one point they even held meetings where we could sit around and chat with staff about what we would like to see there and how we could go about making that happen. So it was, it was, I think, 2005 I saw the sign. So early 2006, summer of 2006, we were sitting with city staff talking about how we could move forward with the development in that positive way. But also we had formed what we called a association, because in the learning, Adam, we learned about the OMB. And
right.
So we knew the OMB would be a last draw if we weren't able to get what we thought was important.
Mm-hmm.
And so in learning about the OMB, we discovered that if you want to be a participant, that you should be a formal organization. So that
right.
was a lot of work to become an association. We had to have corporation laws. We had to buy laws. We had a constitution. So we had to have formal positions within our association so that we would be a recognized group when it came to going to the OMB if that were to happen.
Mm-hmm. And it did actually happen. It wasn't, you might have to help me on the dates, but I think it was 2009 this started rumbling about heading to the OMB.
That's true. I believe in 2007, City Council turned the application down in the format that it was presented, which was the 450,000 square foot of, 450,000 square feet of commercial.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to back up a moment, if you don't mind, that
nope.
When we were considering this as a council, we had just finished what we call the commercial policy review. You may even remember this. The commercial
mm-hmm.
policy review was we had come up with a plan as a city to expand the four corners of our city, and that's where we decided we could put our big box stores, our warehouse-type stores. And the first commercial pod, as you know, was Walmart.
Right. The Smart Center.
You probably heard we fought that for 12 years. And then...
did a reunion podcast about it, actually.
And yes, you did. And so the four corners, I'll call them, or pods of our city was supposed to be where the big commercial development went, which made a lot of sense at the time. We were trying to do smart growth. We had a growth plan. So council did approve the commercial policy review, and we were ready to go with our commercial in the four corners. And then, of course, along came this application, which somewhat superseded the process because we had already decided where we were going to put our big box stores and our commercial. So one of the really strong arguments was that, hey, how can, I believe the developer at the time was Rosewater. How can he jump in and ask for official plan amendment when we've just said we want to develop the Four Corners?
Right.
And, of course, that's how Armel got involved also in the OMB, because they were developing out in the West End.
Right.
And they weren't happy about hearing that a commercial development was going to be going ahead of them. Now, I think when the application came forward, it was the developer's intention to put in a Leon's.
Yeah.
That didn't happen because it got held up with the neighborhood and then got held up with the OMB. And then I think his second plan was Costco.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, Costco ended up over on the Armel property.
And Leon's is at Willow West Mall now.
Right. Leon's is at Willow. And then the other one was... the last one would have been Lowe's, and I believe Lowe's is going in Elmira Road too. So,
and of course, there's been some delay on that. And I think Mayor Guthrie mentioned in his Facebook town hall last month that actually Lowe's acquiring Rona might have delayed that because there is a Rona on Dawson Road.
Yes, I think that's true. Yes.
So the best laid plans, as it were. Armel is an interesting player in this because. I think a lot of people looked at the situation and thought, well, here's the city again being an anchor on potential development. And that kind of wasn't the case at all. The neighborhood group, the city, the developer had all managed to work together and come up with something that everyone was going to find palatable, that sort of served everybody needs. But then Armel is kind of an X factor in this because maybe five blocks away, they have their commercial development that they're constructing. Or, well, it's constructed. You can go into Zayre's today, but it's still a development in progress.
Yes, they were an interesting party because they were at the OMB, and I know that their argument at the OMB was that we have development going in the West End, and why should this applicant be able to jump the queue when we've been working on within the confines of your commercial policy review? And that indeed was the case.
Mm-hmm. So I think we're kind of up to around 2013, and by this point you've been on council for several years. It seems like, you know, this is kind of where the story ended until it's picked up this past summer. There was an agreement reached through the OMB through that process. But that seemed to be the end of it for some reason.
That's true. That was my sense as well. I did want to clarify that when the application came to council, I had to declare a conflict. So I worked really, really hard with the neighborhood before I was an elected official. I worked really hard on the application during my first term. Along came the application, and then I have to go, whoa, I'm in a conflict of interest, a pecuniary interest, because it's right in my neighborhood, as I didn't state in the beginning, but it's just in my neighborhood.
Right.
Not far, maybe 120 meters from where I live. So, of course, I had to declare a conflict, so I wasn't able to be in the horseshoe to push the yes or no button, which was didn't seem very fair at the time, but...
Did you decide that, or was that something that was recommended to you that maybe because of your active involvement?
It was secretly kind of planted, and then I decided that I best protect my interest as a counselor because I loved my job and I didn't want to be fired. That doesn't happen. They usually just suspend you. But what I did was I sought out my own legal counsel. Because as a city councilor, you don't use the services of our legal department.
Right.
That would be a conflict. So I went to...
They represent the city, not the individual councilor.
Exactly. So I found my own lawyer, and his advice was to me that, yes, you are in a pecuniary interest. And even if it isn't a pecuniary interest, it could be perceived as a conflict of interest.
Right.
So, yes, I had to bow out at that time. So that was... that didn't seem very fair to me. But so you were asking about 2013. So we, when we went to the OMB, there were what they call minutes of settlement.
Mm-hmm.
So Armel, the City of Guelph, and the neighborhood group, they spent hours and weeks at an OMB hearing, and there were minutes of settlement decided upon by the adjudicator of the OMB, and the minutes of settlement were signed off. So the important message here is that the neighborhood spent over $50,000 on lawyer fees, planner fees, traffic studies. So we had a big debt at the time, and we were doing pasta dinners and garage sales, but we couldn't even get close to the $50,000 that we had spent. So the minutes of settlement, as I said, they were signed and agreed upon. And what the minutes of settlement did, there is a good piece of the story here that I want to share, and is that is that we went from 450,000 square feet to 287,000 square feet of commercial.
Mm-hmm.
No grocery store, which was big. It had to be mixed nodes, so it had to be high-density residential, it had to be employment lands, and it had to be commercial. There was a holding zone put on the lands until the underpass was agreed upon, because it was very obvious that you couldn't have that amount of commercial and expect not to have it on a through street.
Yeah.
So there was a big win there, and we did get that beautiful green space with the trail on the other side of the creek.
Right.
I don't know if you've walked on that side, but with the paved trail. So, and it's a beautiful green space. So there were some wins there. And I thought that was that's important to mention, so people do realize that the neighborhood group worked hard, and we did have some minor victories.
Yeah, and when you go there now, the green you still see standing, that was the agreement that if the development had went forward in 2013, that's what it would have looked like before they started building.
Correct. Yeah, and it would have been right up to the triangle would have been developed too, but we had that lands, I guess you would say, saved for a green space or a park. So that's been very beneficial to our neighborhood. But yeah, so 2013, you said we would skip up to 2013. We hadn't heard much, and that's not true. He came back, the developer came back in 2012 and wanted to put in another application, amended application. And that amended application, Adam, was to include a grocery store, to take some of the holding area off, the holding zone area, and to, there was one other thing, the grocery store, the holding area, and, to be able to increase the square footage by, I think, 10,000 meters or something. So
just so the timeline is right in my head, but was that before or after the agreement?
After the minutes of settlement.
So the settlement is reached, and then he comes back to Hamilton and says, no, wait, I really do want a grocery store. I don't want to hold on the lands. I want more space.
That's absolutely true. He came back about a year later. I mean, the neighborhood, we were all in shock. I was in shock as a counselor. So I arranged a meeting, of course, with staff so we could walk the neighborhood through what was happening and understanding again how this could happen, because who would have thought? We shook hands, and it was a good deal. Mm-hmm. And okay, move on. But he did come back, and one of the things that he wanted was a grocery store. So we did some, again, some negotiations there, and in the end, the grocery store is now accepted, and I believe it's maybe can't be greater than 100,000 square feet, but there were some concessions made, and one of the wins for the neighborhood was that he agreed to pay off our debt.
Okay.
And that was close to $30,000 or $35,000. So he agreed to do that. So we took him up on the offer, of course. And so, yeah, that happened in 2012. And then we didn't hear anything, like you said, for a very long time. We did, occasionally, when budget came up, I would see that the DC charges for the underpass were pushed a little bit forward every year. So I remember sending an email off to staff and discovering that the development charges would be moved into 2021. So I went, wow, I guess nothing's going to happen before 2021. Because
that was the last budget?
Yes, because we're not going to be, until they do the underpass in the minutes of settlement, it's very clear that they can't do anything until the underpass is negotiated and that it's been contracted out. So yeah, we, that would have been around 2015. I think I was questioning that in 2015, 2016 budget. That would be right. And that's that was significant to me because I thought, okay, we don't ever have to worry. We've got 4 or 5 years,
right.
And big box stores, I think they're dying out, and people aren't really interested in big box stores. This, I mean, that's not necessarily true, but I think that the big box stores are downsizing.
Right.
So I was hopeful that, you know, by 2021, it would be a different use. And I was quite excited to have the property as employment lands and high density residential and a little main street. But
it seems weird given, you know, maybe not so weird 5 years ago, given how fast everything moves now. But certainly in 2017, if this is still the plan, because you do have No Frills up further on Silver Creek. You have Food Basics a little further up on Silver Creek. You have Zehrs over on Imperial, and then you have Costco now on Elmira. And then I can imagine that if ground is broken tomorrow on a grocery store on Silver Creek Parkway South, there's going to be a lot of disgruntlement in the East End. And, you know, that's...
Oh, that would be true. I know a couple of counselors that would be very angry about that.
Yes. Is it the same developer in play? He's still moving forward?
Yes. They are called the Silver Creek Guelph Junction, and there's the Silver Creek Guelph Development Corp is what they go by. So I guess when I came back in from holidays last fall, maybe in the spring, I was walking the property and I saw these little orange and green paintball circles on some of the trees, and I thought, oh, kids have been paintballing here, isn't that fun? And many months later I discovered that he was doing a tree inventory, which was a step that he had to take to be able to get in onto the property and start to cut the trees down, and so I was as shocked as the community was when we discovered that he was given a tree permit to remove 2,000 trees from the property, and that I learned of just this past July.
Yeah. It dropped on Friday afternoon of Hillside Weekend.
That is correct.
And I do remember getting it because I was at Red Brick at the time with my laptop, and it came up, and it was around 4. It was almost
4:10.
Yeah. It was almost the very end of the workday, and I think in so much as people in the area were angry about this happening in the first place, I think there was an accelerated anger factor that it was a take out the trash move. It was, you know, 4 o'clock on a Friday on a weekend where a lot of the, you know, to be honest, a lot of the environmental people who would get really upset about this would probably be up at Guelph Lake and not looking at their phones. So,
yeah, you have a point there. I never thought about the hillside connection, but yeah, that's true.
But it seems kind of hinky in that regard. It seems almost too coincidental to be purposeful, is what I'm thinking.
I wouldn't go that far. You can say that. I won't say that. But I think that staff didn't realize the connection or were not aware of the strong connection to that land by our community. By myself, I had been with that property, as I said, since 2005. So 12 years, that property has been on my radar. So I think they just were... not aware that there was that the community had taken ownership of the property,
or they might have thought it like it's that people have been expecting this for some time. It's
right.
Not a big deal.
Exactly, it's not a big deal because they knew that the trees were going to be coming down, that it was going to be developed. But on the contrary, I just assumed because, as I said, the development charges being removed, that it was my assumption and perhaps a mistake that wasn't going to happen for a long time. So the other shocking thing that occurred for me was that, you know, we had signed the minutes of settlement, not me. I keep saying we as if I'm a part of the neighborhood group. That's not true. But the neighborhood group had signed off on the minutes of settlement to say that they could not do any site alterations. until the underpass was the contracts were signed and the money was there. But what I learned, which was quite significant for me, is that site alterations doesn't mean removing vegetation and the trees.
Right.
So do you understand that? So I was thinking that, as was the neighborhood, site alterations, they can't go in there and do anything.
Right.
But we found out after, you know, I called the city and said, you know, what about these site alterations? It's in the minutes of settlement. They're not adhering to the minutes of settlement. Well, indeed they were, because vegetation and tree removal is not part of site alterations. Now, how is a neighborhood supposed to know when they sign a document exactly what they're signing? So this has been a big lesson for me around the minutes of settlement.
Yeah.
That it should have been laid out in more lay language.
Yeah. Everybody thought that the announcement would come that work was going to start on the underpass, and then that was kind of going to be the opening indication that the development on the planned was going to start in due time.
Exactly.
Do you wonder, and you know, maybe you're not sure, but do you wonder if maybe the neighborhood let their guard down? That you know, it's been 5 years since that settlement, that maybe everybody in that area just gotten used that this is a big open space. You know, there's no sign that anyone is going to put shovel in the ground anytime soon. No one's really talking about it. No plans have come to City Hall. It just, you know, this is the way it's going to be.
Yes, I think that we just went on with our day-to-day and loved having the use of the property, and thought that if they weren't going to be putting the underpass, doing the construction on the underpass, that it was going to just be our property until that time. And yeah, I think we just were appreciating and enjoying the property, and there was never any no trespassing signs up. There was never any warning that this was going to happen. And I think we just assumed that it was going to be a long time down the road before they were going to come in with the bulldozers and start the underpass.
Mm. Well, now that land has been shorn, shall we say, what do you think it's going to look like? Because in the immediate future, again, nothing can go there until the underpass. And then you were talking several minutes ago about how it's on the books, but it's maybe 2021, 2022, and that's another 5 years in the future. And then in the meantime, we come from this week's committee meeting when there was that big debate about, you know, how much resources do we put to repairing existing infrastructure? How much do we put towards city building? It could be even further back before there's an underpass put there. So in, you know, 5 years from now, is there going to be building on that site, do you think?
Yeah, I'm uncertain. I don't believe that the developer would decide that the property is a risk now when it's been sitting like that for 12 years or even longer. Decide that it was going to be a risk and that they had to manage the risk. I don't think that just came. I think that I have a strong opinion that there is going to be an application come forward very soon. I think that they're probably setting up some kind of a meeting to have a pre-consult. That's a new process at City Hall, where they go in and they have a pre-consultation with staff before the actual application comes forward.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we are going to see some kind of application coming forward, whether it's a condensed version, whether it's trying to develop one corner of it, whether it's working with the city perhaps to look for infrastructure money to bring some money forward to get going on the underpass. That's another idea that I was thinking on my way here today, that there is infrastructure money being offered, and it's coming down the tube. You heard that the other night at council.
Yeah.
So perhaps staff are working or will work with the developer to see, to make that happen, to get us the infrastructure money that will get that underpass built.
Mm.
But I don't believe that the risk management and the cost of that property would just happen. I think that there is some kind of plan that, and I believe this fall we will see an application come forward, my sense. not. that's just my sense. I have no proof of that, but that's what I really believe that. And Adam, you have said you haven't been there since the community gathering. I held that community gathering because I felt that people needed an opportunity to mourn and share stories and talk about the property. And it was a very successful event, and mm-hmm. it was very helpful for many people. But you haven't been there since, you said you haven't been there since that community gathering.
No, I haven't been there since they had the protest day before the civic holiday weekend.
Correct.
When the machines started arriving.
Yes, and I was on vacation then, and I heard that was quite successful. And
I would say so. And yeah, but I have not been down there. So I've gone past there and seen, you know, more open area,
right.
Fewer trees that obstructing the view. Towards the south end, but yeah, I have not been on site.
So I think the neighborhood really did I don't call it a protest. I think they were just there to bear witness, but I think they rallied, and I really appreciated them taking the time out of their lives to do that. But so I would love for you to come, and we'll take a walk around the property. I go there every morning. It's private property, and I am trespassing, but I go really early in the morning because that is a public road, Silver Creek, and it is. It fills me with sadness every day. And people say, well, why do you go? Well, I feel I have to bear witness too, because it's devastation there. It's devastation. We had this beautiful green forest and this open green space, and it has now been just devastated. And to bear witness to that was important to me. So I do go there and I pay attention. And we have had somewhat of an influx of wild animals into our neighborhood. My neighbor's chickens have been killed. And
oh, really?
Yeah, I've seen lots of snakes since I've been walking there.
So really?
They're scattering about. They're not really sure where to go and what to do, because as you know, the Hanlon's on one side and the neighborhood's on the other. So yes, I would love it if you could come down and have a walk around with me. We'll do that on the sly so we're not caught trespassing. But there is, you asked me earlier what I picture there. They haven't done any of the grading, but it was horrific to watch that devastation and to see how they just cut down the trees and left just dirt there and some mulch. It's a very sad place right now.
Well, we thank you for your witness testimony today, and I hope for the listeners out there, it was enlightening to get that history and that you were a firsthand part of. So, June Hoffman, thanks for coming by today.
Thank you very much, Adam.
And once again, that was Ward 3 City Councilor June Hoffman. You can consult the Guelph Politico archive for coverage of development of the Lafarge site, including recent protests, and a reprinting of an article I wrote for The Ontarian in 2008 about how far the negotiations had gotten to that point. As for the Guelph Politicast, that is all for this week. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The host for the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes, and while you're there, you can also listen to Open Sources Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson. You can go to the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/PoliticoGuelph. And you can donate to Guelph Politico on Patreon at patreon.com/GuelphPolitico. If you like locally sourced independent media in the city of Guelph, please consider donating. And thanks to, we did pick up a couple of new subscribers this week. And so I very much appreciate any and all contributions people are willing to provide. For all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca, where we will have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.